The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon in for Virginia Prescott. Shining seas, amber waves of grain, purple mountains' majesty, America the Beautiful presents a vision of the nation as a kind of utopia, a wide, varied terrain of rustic beauty where men and women roam free and good is crowned with brotherhood. But the reality of America's open spaces is far from utopian, and the land is not free to all. In fact, visitors to America's national parks are overwhelmingly white. According to a 2011 report from the National Park Service, only 7% of annual park visitors were African American. So, what accounts for the discrepancy? In her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Carolyn Finney delves into environmental history and cultural studies to find out why the story of the American outdoors is so white. Carolyn Finney is assistant professor of environmental science, policy, and management at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also the chair of the Relevancy Committee for the National Parks Advisory Board. This is her conversation with Virginia from last year.
Well, that 7% number really hit me. What does it reveal, however? Simply that African Americans are not visiting national parks, or do they have a different relationship to the parks and nature in general?
I think it tells us something more about, you know, who we are as a country, that it's important to understand that the national parks don't exist separate from all the issues we have had both historically and in the present having to do with race and difference, the struggles that we continue to have, you know, to talk and relate across that difference. The parks aren't separate from that. So in many ways, it's like I'm always surprised when people are surprised by that statistic. But if I were talking about something like the criminal justice system and bringing up race and ethnicity and difference, people wouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
The parks are no different. We have a complicated legacy in this country, even in terms of how the parks were founded in this country. We have to understand that when the parks were founded in this country, there were people living in a lot of those places. There were Native people living in a lot of those places that had to be removed. I have to be really careful, right? I'm not trying to paint one group of people as being bad and another group of people as being good. I actually don't find that to be a useful conversation. What I'm trying to point to is the complexity. So when someone tells me that statistic, like you said, 7%, the first thing that it points to is the complexity of our history, the legacy of that history, and what that looks like today.
Well, let's look a little bit at that legacy. How far back do we need to go to understand the African-American relationship to the environment?
So what I would say is, and those who've heard me say this before, you know, I went to, a couple of years ago in Detroit, I went to the Charles Wright Museum. And at the present, the Charles Wright Museum has the largest permanent exhibit of African-American history in the United States. And that'll change because the Smithsonian African-American Museum is being built as we speak. And I tell people, when you come into that, when you look at the trajectory of African-American history as represented by the museum, you kind of start off where you're at the gate of no return in West Africa,
mm-hmm.
you know, imagining yourself as an enslaved African. You're suddenly walking into the hull of a boat, and the way the museum has it set up, it's two stories. So the first story is supposed to be the deck of a boat where you see images of white slave owners with the whips in their hand. And if you go below deck, you see representations of black bodies like sardines lying on shelves next to each other. And then once you walk through the hull of the boat and you're on the east coast of the United States, and the first image that you see of an African American on American soil, it's an auction block, and then you see an image of an African American toiling the land, working somebody else's land. So that's how far back you have to go if we really believe in the roots of our past. And yes, in some ways, it's very African-American, but it's all of our history in this country.
And at the same time, you know, there was this sense of expansion, you know, in American history.
Yes.
The move out west, you know, there was,
yes.
that's where the promise was. The Homestead
yes.
Act, you know, you can
yes.
have land if you just work it. So,
well, who the you is what's in question.
Right.
Who
if
could
you're
have
a European or you're an American of European descent, not yeah. an African American, certainly not a Native American, certainly.
Right.
But I'd like to just move forward to your own relationship with the land, your family's relationship with the land as you were growing up, where your father was a steward working the land for somebody else.
Yeah, and I want to say that both my parents were. So my parents were originally from Virginia. They grew up poor, high school education in a small town called Floyd. My father went off to the Korean War, and when he came back from the war, like a lot of black folks, you know, at that time, in the 40s and 50s, who were living in the South, he said to my mother, they got married, and said, let's move north. We'll have a better opportunity as black people in terms of getting a job. And so he came up to New York. And he basically had two job options. He could be a janitor in Syracuse, New York, and Syracuse is about 5 hours north of New York City, or about 30 minutes outside of the city, there was a 12-acre estate owned by a very wealthy Jewish family called the Tishmans. And for anybody who's ever been to New York City, there's the Tishman Building. They own a lot of real estate in New York City. And they needed caretakers for that estate. They needed a couple to live on that estate full-time, 12 acres, swimming pool, lake. So my parents took that job. This was in Westchester County. And so we lived in the gardener's cottage on that property. During the week, it was like our own private park playing. We played outside all the time. You know, we could play outside. This was like in the 60s and 70s, right? But we were also in a very wealthy white neighborhood. So I tell people that Schaefer, who of Schaefer Beer, lived next door to us. Wingfield Golf Club was about a 3-minute walk around the corner. So this is a very wealthy white neighborhood. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood. I still remember some of the stories, me and my brothers. I mean, I loved the idea of playing outside. But I also tell people, I remember when I was 9 years old, walking home from school one day, and you always had police patrolling the neighborhood because there was so much wealth in the neighborhood. And, you know, I was really unimpressive. You know, I had a little afro, my little reading glasses, my little school bag. And I got stopped by a cop right around the corner from my house. And he said, where are you going? And I gave him the address. And he said, oh, do you work there? And I was 9. And I'm thinking, dude, I live there. But, you know, I'm not saying that out loud. So I just said, no, I live there. And I remember being really confused by the fact that he thought I worked there. And going home and telling my parents, and my dad then called the police station and really gave him a hard time about that. And then they never stopped me or my brothers again. That's the kind of stuff that's embedded. And this is the conversations we have in a lot of different circles today around race and difference that come up all the time.
We're talking with Carolyn Finney, who's the author of a book called Black Faces, White Spaces. It's about challenging the ideas that we have about the relationships between African Americans and the great outdoors, be it camping, be it adventuring, be it environmentalism. Carolyn, I'd like to address some of the stereotypes about black people in the outdoors here. We have a clip here from the black media web series Black Folk Don't. Now, this is from the Black Folk Don't Camp episode.
Camping? I just don't see it.
You can't really generalize to say all black folk. Most of them, though, don't camp. Because out in the woods with the bugs and all that stuff. For some reason, we don't like animals. We don't like wild things. We don't like things that we can't control.
We don't like campsites. We don't like tents.
I wouldn't, for the most part, do it unless, I guess, I had like some protection on me.
I was in the Boy Scouts, and I didn't want to go camping. Camping is not in our blood.
Carolyn, you had an experience of living outside. I mean, to what extent are these stereotypes actually perpetuated, but within the African-American community?
So I think that's a great question, because I am a person who believes that we all have agency. And what I mean by that is we all have choice. But as someone, as an African-American, as a human being, as a person, I like to feel like I do have some choice in my life. And I first of all, I don't speak for all African-Americans, and I need to say that, too. I also understand that, you know, collectively, we have worked over time to define who we are for ourselves. There was a period of time in the 60s, in particular, when it was about black as beautiful, black power, and it was a beautiful time. And two black psychiatrists wrote a book called Black Rage, and they talk about, it's great, our ledge grew, you know, in terms of who we could be as black people. But they also asked the question, have we also shrunk our ledge? So if you love French cinema, or let's change it up, if you love to camp, are you black enough?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a black thing to do? But in listening to those comments, there's some truth to the fact that some black people don't like to camp. You know what? Some white people don't like to camp as well.
Right.
But it doesn't change the fact that we all have a relationship with the environment and the outdoors. If you are breathing, you have a relationship. I don't care if you live in the country, in the suburbs, or in the city. You know, we stand on land, we breathe air, we eat food, we engage with it either consciously or unconsciously every day. One of the things that was really powerful to me is when I was interviewing black people, that many of them, when I would ask them things like, how do you define environment? Or if I say parks, what comes to mind for you? Or I would say, tell me your story about the environment. Some of them would say, I don't have a story. And I would, of course, go, everyone's got a story. And at the end, a few of them would say to me, no one's ever asked me that before. And for me, that's where the power was, that no one's ever asked them about their own story.
Well, historically, have visits to national parks been a white thing because African Americans may have been even barred from entering a park?
You know, at the core of the national parks, you know, and I think there was some really good intention and ideas and bigger dreams about what this country means and how we want to represent ourselves. And we do have these extraordinary places like the Grand Canyon. I think there was something really pure and good. But it doesn't exist separately from all the realities of all the violence that took place around a lot of those lands and on those a lot of those lands, to understand the violence that continues to take place around a lot of those lands, to understand that you have groups of people from various walks of life that are still fighting over their right to engage those spaces in the way that they believe is appropriate. So the parks don't exist separately. The parks, just because there's another story that I like to tell about during the civil rights, because you had all these beautiful parks, but segregation was also happening.
Right.
Right? It didn't change just because it was a national park, you know, even though at the core, the national parks are trying to do something really good, I believe. One of the stories I think I write about in the book is that there was a white professor out of Boston, sort of early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, who wanted to go visit Fundy Bay National Park, which is just over the border in Canada. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to take an African-American couple with him. And he knew that this was, you know, during the time of segregation, Canada's just right over the border. So he wrote the folks up, the superintendent, the folks up at Fundy Bay, to say, you know, I just want to let you know I'm bringing this African-American couple with me. You know, I want them to be treated with respect. I want them to have a good time. When he finally got a response back from the Fundy Bay National Park, the folks there, they said, you know, we're really sorry. We can't promise you that they'll be treated well because we get a lot of American visitors here. And then we find out that the people he wanted to bring there were Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, who wanted to take a break from the civil rights movement, you know, take time to write all the things that Howard Zanizer and others who are creating the Wilderness Act at the same time the Civil Rights Act was taking place. All those ideas that I really believe they would have said, yes, absolutely, that's what you should be able to do. But they couldn't even do it across the border.
Well, but how about today? I mean, are environmentalists and conservation groups accountable for the lack of diversity?
There's a dominant narrative, right, about how we think about and have thought about the environment and the outdoors in this country. A lot of mission statements are grounded in that dominant narrative. And what that dominant narrative doesn't do is address the complex histories for people like African Americans and other non-white peoples, where it doesn't look all nice like that. It wasn't about John Muir being able to go into a park and talk about why we need to preserve this space, because he doesn't really talk about the fact that Native people had to be removed in order for that to take place, and that John Muir also looked down upon African Americans. And I'm not trying to diminish John Muir. What I'm trying to say is the man was a human being who was flawed, who lived in a country that, you know, that strive to take on and engage this idea of democracy, which I think is amazing, and how difficult that was, and I believe is and still is. When you talk about engaging all the different kinds of people with our different beliefs, our different ways of living, our different ways of showing up, and outdoor spaces are not immune for that. They're not separate from that. So it's not, for me, it's not about everybody showing up at every national park, right? But there is something about, you know, I believe national parks are key to telling the story of who we are. I think it's important that not only that we visit the parks, but that we can also work at the parks. It's also about employment. Who gets to have a job? Who gets to be a superintendent? Who gets to decide what narratives and stories are told? What does it mean for a young child let's say a young non-white child, for instance, to come to a park and see somebody who looks like them and imagine, hey, maybe I could do this job. You know what I'm saying? I mean, sometimes we make really simple decisions when we're really young based on what we see and who is represented and where we think we might be welcome and how we might consider something we never considered before, like being in the outdoors. But there's multiple ways to engage the great outdoors. There's multiple ways to engage environmental issues.
That was Virginia's previous conversation with Carolyn Finney, Assistant Professor of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also the author of Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. You'll find a link to more information on the book on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon in for Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we spoke about the long history of politicizing public spaces. But what happens in cities where public spaces are considered so necessary that private owners are mandated to create them by city planners? Host Roman Mars and the podcast 99% Invisible explore just how public a space is when it's owned by a corporation.
This is Stephanie Fu.
The plaza and seating area of this building are provided and maintained for the enjoyment of the public from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Privately owned public open space.
POPOS.
P-O-P-O-S.
And it has this logo that says public open space, and with kind of this little like tree that's shaped like a house. And all of them have the same logo. The city requires that logo to be on there.
It's a cool logo.
Yeah. Pretty small sign though. My name's Blaine Merker. I'm an artist and part of a group of artists and designers called Rebar. We're based in San Francisco. POPO, they're a kind of unique set of spaces that were required to be provided by the developer as a condition of approval for the developer's building.
So the POPOs are on private property. They're owned most likely by the owner of the building.
They look like public space. They feel like public space for the most part. This one that we're standing in is granite walkways and a fountain and grass.
But technically speaking, these are totally privately owned.
The only catches that the developer is legally obliged to make this open to the public and to allow anyone to use it.
And no one's quite sure what's allowed here, who's in charge, and what the codes of behavior should be. And just because they're public doesn't mean they're easy to find.
So this is sort of a strange environment to walk through to get to a public space.
Yeah, it's got nice art though.
Yeah.
536 Mission.
It feels like walking into a library. You'll see when we walk through security, like, there'll be this moment where you're like, okay, I just crossed a threshold. Making eye contact with people in authority and sort of acknowledging them, that's not something I ever feel in a park, right? I mean, I don't like walk into Dolores Park and have to like nod to somebody like, yes, it's okay that I'm here. There's cameras, 1, 2, 3 cameras in here. You wanna try some badminton?
In here?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, let's do it.
There's a whole set of invisible codes and regulations that shape our behavior. Most of us aren't really consciously aware of them. How you hold yourself in public, where you think you can sit down, who you can talk to. It's only by doing something that push back against those codes that you actually can see the codes. Sort of like a scientist firing an electron at an atom to see where it is. If you fire an electron at an atom, you actually change the course of the atom. When you're in one of these spaces, when you start to push back against the codes of behavior, you actually change the codes of behavior while you do that.
And nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
Was just like, all right.
We're definitely played long enough probably to be noticed on camera, right?
Right. And nobody came.
Nobody came. Score 1 for public space.
But if you really want to test the tolerance of a privately owned public open space, badminton may not be the best test. I mean, if you really want to make someone in authority uncomfortable, the most subversive act, especially right now, may be doing nothing at all.
There's a few behaviors that you can sort of plausibly do that allow you to be idle, like fiddling with your phone, or smoking, or reading a book. But to just like lie down and do nothing, not okay. It draws attention to do nothing.
The San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, which is better known as SPUR, has a great guide to all the POPOs in the city and recommendations about how to improve current and future POPOs, including a proposal to codify some of these rules for the social aspects of privately owned public open spaces. I think it's key to keep in mind that POBOs will never fully supplant the need for a true commons, for true public spaces in a city. POBOs can be these great hidden gems in the nooks and crannies of a city, but even if you're allowed to play badminton, the fact that you have to test for it means these spaces aren't really ours.
And that story came to us from host Roman Mars and the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, filling in for Virginia Prescott. Purchasing tiny teacup pigs as pets spiked after Paris Hilton was photographed with one in 2009, and surged more recently after a pig named Glitzy was introduced on the reality show Here Comes Honey Boo Boo.
This is a new member of our family. His name is Glitzy. I think Alana's gonna love him. We got Glitzy from a place called Posh Pig, and they pretty up their pigs before sending them off with painted toenails and all.
If you didn't catch that, and yes, it does require subtitles, Glitzy was purchased at Posh Pigs as a gift to little Alana, the pint-sized beauty queen who couldn't take care of the little guy and had to give it back to the breeder. That is one fate for these petite porkers, but another issue is that these tiny pigs get big, really big, like Great Dane size, and then their owners give them up. Jake Swearingen wrote a cautionary article for Modern Farmer with the warning, never buy a teacup pig, and Virginia spoke with him about it.
So what is the appeal of the micro pig, also called pocket pig or teacup pigs?
Sure. They're also known as Juliana pigs. Sometimes you'll see them listed as. The appeal is pretty simple. I think if you've ever seen a picture of one, a baby piglet is incredibly adorable. It's small. There are pictures of them actually fitting within teacups. And I think the idea of just having this incredibly small, adorable pet that in pictures at least seems like it would be, you know, maybe about the size of a kitten, a small house cat at best.
Are they an actual breed, the teacup or Juliana pig, or is it just a piglet?
So the teacup pig is just sort of what sellers use to call them. But there is a breed called a miniature Vietnamese potbelly pig that a lot of these teacup pigs that are sold are based on. There's a few other breeds, but that's the main one. The idea being what the sellers will tell you is that these are pigs that were bred and they won't get any bigger than about 30 pounds or so.
So what does happen? Do they get bigger than 30 pounds?
Oh, yeah. According to the veterinarians I talked to, sort of, you know, 130, 140 is really sort of, if you're very lucky, that's where they'll be at. And they can get easily up to 300 or 400 pounds. So, you know, at that point, it's not even bigger than a person. It's, you know, bigger than a couple of people. You know, this happens over the course of 2 or 3 years. You're going to have not something that fits in a teacup, but something that probably can't fit in your bathtub.
Wow. So what if you feed them, as recommended by these teacup breeders, a quarter cup of food a day? That's all it takes.
Well, I guess two things happen. First of all, you are being incredibly cruel because you'll be starving this pig. A quarter cup will keep your pig small because you will be the malnutrition will essentially keep the pig from being unable to grow. But the other thing that will happen is while you basically won't allow the pig's musculature to grow, its skeleton will continue to grow. And you will very quickly have a very angry and upset pig because it is very hungry. Its body is continuing to grow. It doesn't really have the nutrition to support that. And so basically you're going to have a shrieking pig in your home.
That's terrible. Well, you did speak with a woman, a rescuer of abandoned micro pigs. Her business is called Vegas Pig Pets. Is she doing that in the city of Las Vegas?
Yeah, she is. You know, one of the things that happened when sort of miniature pigs took off, or just the idea of having pigs as pets in general, you know, beyond Paris Hilton and Honey Boo Boo, I don't know if you remember, George Clooney was somewhat famous for having a pot-bellied pig that he kept in his house. As these pigs became pets, they became really popular, particularly among people that lived in more suburban areas or, you know, people that have a little bit of space and thought, well, I can have a dog. Why couldn't I have a pig? What happens, though, is that, you know, dogs have been domesticated and dogs have basically, you know, over tens of thousands of years have learned to live with humans and cats to a lesser degree. Pigs, really, we've only kept pigs as food primarily, and pigs are not really set up to live with us comfortably, especially in the sort of you know, environs of a small home. So what happens is people think that they can get a pig. It'll basically be a, you know, cute, smart dog. And instead what they have is an animal that evolutionary-wise is a prey animal. So it views most things as predator or threat. It is going to grow very large. Males can get aggressive. And so people have to give them up. Mm-hmm. And that's where the organizations like this Vegas organization comes into play.
So what does she do? She tries to place them, what, out in the country or in new homes or what?
Exactly. She tries to place them in new homes. She tries to place them on farms. She takes care of many herself. But, you know, talking to her and looking at other rescue organizations, the sad fact is that there's just a lot more pigs than there are homes that want them.
Although she does say that she can't really blame people. You know, they think they're getting a Chihuahua and it grows into a German Shepherd, which doesn't work in a lot of places, and puts the blame squarely on the breeders. Now, who does sell them and how much do they cost?
I tried to talk to a few of them. Most of them were obviously very reluctant to talk to me. They are very fly-by-night operations. You'll find, you know, if you start Googling, you'll find them on the internet relatively quickly. They can go from anywhere to about $750 to, I saw some that were going up for about $3,500.
Wow.
So yeah, they're expensive. And they will all basically make the same promise that, you know, the pig will not get any bigger than 30 pounds. Some will promise, you know, as low as like 12 pounds, which is really ridiculous. From everything that I could tell and everything that experts told me, it's an extremely unethical business. You know, you are not only doing something extremely cruel to an animal, you're also sort of, you're duping people. You're scamming them, essentially.
And any action against breeders at this point and warnings other than yours?
You know, lots of sort of humane society people have come out repeatedly. You will find plenty of veterinarians, plenty of people that come out and basically say the same thing that I did in my article, which is don't buy them. But as far as I could tell, I never saw anyone prosecuted for it. I never saw anybody really get taken to task. You know, what does seem to happen is, you know, some of the places that I was already looking at that were selling pigs have already gone out of business. Mm. So it's also entirely possible that they went out of business and just started up under a new name.
Well, Jake Swearingen, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Virginia Prescott there speaking with Jake Swearingen about his article for Modern Farmer, Never Buy a Teacup Pig. You'll find a link to read it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Since we first spoke with Jacob about the teacup pig problem, a new inadvisable pet trend has taken off, albeit very slowly, the sulcata tortoise.
As you can see, they're pigging out. We got Fred over here eating some collard greens right now.
Proof that tortoises are becoming hip? Recently, a video of a man walking his giant sulcata tortoise through the streets of Tokyo went viral. Apparently, even Leonardo DiCaprio has one.
This is a baby sulcata that was just hatched out about 6 months ago.
They get big. Adults can weigh in over 200 pounds, but they're very cute, so it's really not surprising that lots of people are getting these calm companions as pets. And sure, they're big, but they're not nearly as wily as the full-grown teacup pigs, right?
All right, so you've gone to the pet store, you've gone to the reptile show, or you've bought or been looking...
The problem with keeping a giant tortoise isn't size, though, it's lifespan. Experts say sulcata tortoises can live to be 100 years old or so in captivity. So if you get one of these for your kids, the tortoise might just outlive them. And not a lot of kids want to bring their 100-pound teenage turtle to college. Fair warning.
I'd better warn the others. Fast!
Smooth move, Michelangelo. What
are you doing? There's a great article in BuzzFeed on some of the other pieces of misinformation that tortoise breeders may give out, and how shelters are struggling to take care of abandoned tortoises. You can check it all out at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. As you may know, we've got a new podcast here at NHPR. It's called Outside In, and it's hosted by Sam Evans Brown. Here's last week's episode, which delved into the world of competitive birding, which is way more intense than any of us realized.
So I can hear American robins in the background.
So, birding.
Chickadees, black-capped chickadee.
Birding, if you're not a birder, seems slow.
Which is the state bird for my state of Massachusetts. I think it's the state bird for almost every other state as well.
And this might look calm, tranquil, meditative.
Song sparrow flying past.
But what you're actually observing here is a sport. And the competition can be pretty intense.
If you're going to do it on a national scale, on a continental scale, the money involved is vast.
and I can't play that game.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In. And today, we are delving into the subculture of extreme birdwatching, where even when those involved say they are not in a competition, they are totally in a competition. One that leads them to crisscross the US and Canada in airplanes and abandon their loved ones for weeks on end while they huddle on windblown Alaskan islands, hoping for bad weather to blow birds across the Pacific Ocean. In 2013, Neil Hayward was depressed. He had just left a biotech company that he had helped to start, but got kind of bored with, and he was getting over the end of a very serious relationship. And suddenly, he found himself doing a lot of birding.
Because I had so much free time that year, I could end up staying, I could put in a lot of hours and wait for birds. And that always paid off. I waited for 8 hours for a hummingbird in southeast Arizona, and just as the sun was setting, this bird came in. And I'd been sitting outside through 2 thunderstorms and rain and was about to give up, and it was just the end of a great day.
If sitting still in the rain for 8 hours doesn't sound like a great day to you, you are not ready to join the ranks of the nation's best birders. Neil, who lives in Boston, is one of the birding elite. Back in 2013, when he was feeling depressed, he decided to do something birders call a big year, trying to see as many species of birds in the U.S. and Canada as he possibly could in 12 months. The first bird he saw that year? A lowly Canada goose.
Things like sparrows. We get really excited about sparrows. All look very similar, and they're pretty drab. And to a non-birder, you might reasonably ask, you know, what's all the fuss about? But I think it's those birds that have some subtlety. Those are the ones that I think take more time and I guess, ultimately more rewarding.
So let's just start with, why birds? I mean, why is birdwatching so popular that it is actually an activity that we've all heard of? You don't hear about people going reptile watching, even though that is a thing. There are people who do this. It's called herping, as in herpetology.
You know, in New England, there's only like 5 or 6 species of frog, so it doesn't take very long to see them all. whereas birding is like almost like the ideal number. You know, you could spend your whole life birding in North America and see new birds every year.
Birdwatching is big. Like 60 million people told the census they are birdwatchers big. That's more than, say, they play basketball. And within that 60 million, there are, of course, varying degrees of enthusiasm. Some just do it in their backyards, but there are tens of millions of people who travel, who actually go places just to see different birds. These are people who keep lists. Lists of birds they've seen in a given state, in a given country, in this year, and in their whole life. Lots of lists. And it's a different kind of person who's attracted to this variety of birding.
And I think a lot of birders are probably, they like bringing order to the universe. And like collecting is one way of doing that, categorizing things. It's that same kind of mentality.
Certain people end up birders.
That was Eric Masterson. He's our go-to guide to birding culture. He works for the Harris Center for Conservation Education here in New Hampshire.
I've seen characteristics and character traits prevalent amongst a lot of the birders that I know. You throw in a little bit of anxiety, throw in a little bit of obsessive compulsion, throw in a little bit of overachievement. I don't know, maybe my next career is going to be some sort of psychoanalytic. Take a master's in psychoanalysis and figure out what it is that drives birders. But I'm actually serious. I think there's something to that.
You could open a practice and just focus on helping birders heal.
Yeah, and I'd be broke.
So let me tell you how the extreme variety of elite birding works. Birds are on the wing. On the move. You never know what you'll see. Who knows? Maybe it'll be something from the other side of the Atlantic that blew its way over here in a storm. When a bird shows up outside of its typical range, birders notice. Now, this doesn't have to be a rare bird. It could be the most common bird ever. We could be talking about a robin, but if it shows up somewhere it's not supposed to be, suddenly it's a rarity. They call this a vagrant, and word starts to spread.
Pagers start ringing, texts go out.
Email list servers start to light up, blogs are updated.
Instant communication.
It doesn't matter what time of day, it doesn't matter what day of the week, birders drop everything.
And, you know, you're talking about lying to the boss to take a sick day, which, you know, it's people do.
Eric remembers two instances of this happening that were kind of extreme. Once in Ireland, when a rather common American bird showed up.
There were jets that were chartered from as far away as Geneva for this thing.
And privately
chartered jets. Get a few people together to privately charter a flight. This bird generated for that local economy in the order of several hundred thousand euro.
And this is not a European phenomenon. Earlier this year in New Hampshire, someone spotted a European redwing. Again, in Europe, this is a pretty common bird. More than 500 birders from all over the country dropped everything to fly here.
Now, you picture Hollis High School. Hollis High School, right? And it was actually, you know, we're in an era where if you have 500 middle-aged men with optics descending on a high school, it kind of rings alarm bells.
Confused police officers, disgruntled neighbors, this is what extreme bird watching looks like. And this is the game that Neil Hayward decided he was going to play. For an entire year, he was glued to birding forums and listservs, waiting for rare bird alerts and chasing them whenever they arrived. Just as an example of the kind of behavior this leads to, once Neil heard that a blue-footed booby, which is normally a Mexican bird, had just landed in New Mexico.
And I flew to Dallas. When I got on the plane in Boston, the bird was still being seen. Numerous reports, lots of birders very happy. And I got to Dallas at midnight and turned my phone on and had a text message from a local birder saying that the bird had gone into rehab. It was emaciated. It wasn't eating.
Even if Neil had been able to get in to see the bird, which he probably could not have, captive birds don't count. They have to be wild.
So I had to get back on the plane that night, 4 o'clock in the morning, flew back to Boston. So obviously a upsetting trip, but obviously more upsetting for the booby.
Neil spent tens of thousands of dollars on his big year and racked up 250,000 frequent flyer miles, spent many, many weeks away from home. And while Neil did his big year, he was also falling in love.
Last year we did a trip down to Central America, and we also stayed in this canopy tower that was just set above the canopy of the rainforest, and that's something that I never thought I would do in my life.
Jerry Hayward is now Neil's wife. Now, this might strike you as a difficult way to live if you wanted to live with another person, but I think very often significant others of birders become de facto birders themselves.
But he's also taken me to a lot of trash dumps in New Jersey and Connecticut. Those were some of our first dates, so.
As December rolled around in Neil Hayward's big year, he was only 8 birds shy of the record of seeing 748 birds in a single year. He had spent weeks on end on weather-beaten Alaskan islands way out in the Bering Sea trying to spot Asian birds that had been blown off course. He'd been to the islands all the way out at the very end of the Florida Keys called the Dry Tortugas. He'd been to the Canadian Rockies, the American Rockies, the Santa Rita Mountains, the Appalachian Mountains, and countless wildlife refuges and state parks. But he says it was only right there at the very end of the year that he thought, hey, I might beat the record. I might see more birds in the U.S. and Canada in a year than anyone else has ever.
The record was 748. There's a couple of mallards flying in front of us.
See? He never stops birding.
At the beginning of December, I was on sort of low 740s. And that was exciting. I mean, and I thought, there's a good chance that I won't beat the record. And then does that mean that this is all a failure? That, you know, that I didn't do what I was supposed to do?
As those final 30 days are ticking down, Neil is traveling frantically from Texas way out into the Aleutian Islands, then to California and to Florida, and then way up north to Homer, Alaska, trying to find those last 8 birds. Finally, he ends the big year on a boat off the coast of North Carolina, where he saw a great skua.
At the end of the year, I hadn't beaten the record, and I was still waiting for a couple of those ABA firsts that had never been seen before to be accepted.
And so this is the final thing you need to know about elite birding. If you had any doubt as to whether this is actually a sport, guess what? There are referees.
Oh, the Grand American Birding Association. they're the group that sort of manages the US and Canadian list.
There are birds that count and birds that don't. If you see a bird that's not on the list, you'd better have a camera with you. You'd better get a good photo. Neil saw a Eurasian sparrowhawk and spent all day trying to get a good picture by holding his iPhone camera up to his telescope lens. But ultimately, the ABA rejected his sighting. He also saw an American condor. Remember, condors had been nearly wiped out and then were released back into the wild, and their population was rebounding. But according to the ABA rules,
they hadn't been in the wild for long enough. Ironically, the year afterwards, then they were added to the list. So if I'd done my big year in 2014, then I would have been able to count that.
So birding, it's got rules, it's got fierce competition, though it's largely on the honor system, and it's got superstars. Eventually, Neil Hayward's big year was declared the biggest ever. A common red start and a rufous-necked wood rail that he saw were both accepted by the ABA, and he broke the big year record by one bird in June of 2015. Neil's record didn't stand for long, though. This year, there are two birders who have already passed his mark, and a third might still get there. I talked to Neil before hearing this news, and so I called him up. And he pointed out he actually got a late start and didn't get going in earnest until April. So this doesn't stir any desire in you to start over again next year and actually start at January 1st?
when I started doing my big year, I told people that I would never do a big year. The whole idea of it sounded crazy and just kind of insane and a lot of work, a lot of travel. And I said I would never do that. And I ended up doing it. So even though now I say I will never go back and do it again, who knows?
Yeah. We are creatures that we do ourselves do not understand.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to hear more stories about crazy birding, Neil Hayward wrote a book about his big year. It's called Lost Among the Birds. Between its covers, you'll find much more about the odd and wonderful culture of birding. And hey, you might learn some things about individual birds, too.
And that story came to us from Sam Evans Brown and the Outside In podcast. You can listen to past episodes and subscribe to make sure you don't miss the next one at outsideinradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from the United States Navy Band, Broke for Free, David Says Tay, Blue Dot Sessions, Aaron Zim, and La Vagenza Digitara. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Don't forget that you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or in Google Play. And do us a favor, if you like the podcast, give us a rating. It'll help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.